Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Andrew D. Turner, Senior Research Specialist at the Getty Research Institute. Trained as an archaeologist and as an art historian, his work focuses on ancient Mesoamerican material culture, symbolism, and cross-cultural interaction. And we're talking about the book he edited and contributed to, Codex Maya de Mexico, Understanding the Oldest Surviving Book of the Americas. Andrew, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book. This is a really interesting book.
Thank you, Mark. I'm happy to be here.
A lot of people don't realize an awful lot of things about the Mayan civilization, but one of them I'm sure they don't realize is that they were a literate culture. Talk about that.
Oh, absolutely. So we have a lot of texts. Most of them are on monuments or on ceramic vessels, but they made a lot of books, in fact. So only three books survive, and most of them were made just before the time of the arrival of the Spanish. But there's sort of indirect evidence that they were making books probably at least 1,000 years before that. There's images of scribes decorating books. There's a couple of fragments that have been found.
These books, let's talk about physically these books. Were they transported? Who read these books?
Well, not a lot is known about that. At least, when we're dealing with the classic period Maya from about the years 300 to 900 or so, they're often shown in royal courts and often in supernatural scenes. So it seems to be kind of an elite thing, like maybe rulers or priests or somebody like that, sort of in the higher up echelons of society would read and use them. In terms of whether or not they traveled, I think that's a really interesting question. And I think the answer is probably yes, they absolutely did travel. They're very small and lightweight. And we actually do see among different cultures in Mesoamerica a lot of shared common themes within these books. So it does seem like there was a lot of kind of cross-cultural scribal activity.
When I look at the Mayan written language, it seems incredibly complex to try to think about translating. Can you give me a short history about how it was eventually figured out how to translate the Mayan written language?
It's a really interesting story. So there was a Spanish friar who basically got a Maya informant to write down an alphabet. So the Spanish friar, he understood written language as being alphabetic in form. So he basically asked the informant, how do you say ah, how do you say be, how do you say se, and the informant wrote down little symbols. People couldn't do anything with this for a long time. No matter how they tried, they tried to make it work with inscriptions, but it just didn't work out. So in the 1940s and 50s, it was a Russian scholar who was dealing with a facsimile of one of these four Maya books. And he basically realized that the symbols weren't letters, but they were actually syllables. So that was really the breakthrough moment. And he was able to basically start piecing together little bits and pieces of the language and words, comparing the syllabic sounds he was finding with modern-day speech that Maya were making, modern-day languages. So it's been an ongoing process, and I think scholars are about 80 to 90% there with
wow.
Ability to translate, but it's still a work in progress.
Was there only one written language for the Mayas, or was it like Egypt where there's one that was used for, sort of official documents and one written for regular things?
That's a good question. I think as far as we know, there's really only one language, but it almost seems to have worked like Latin did in the Middle Ages, to where it's sort of a prestige language that's used by a lot of different groups that might actually speak different languages. So that's part of the beauty of it, and it kind of maybe probably seems to mask the actual diversity among the ancient Maya that would have existed.
So am I to infer from that the only people who could read the written language would be people who were part of the court or part of the power structure of the Mayan culture?
I think that's probably true, especially at some cities. They really... legibility doesn't really seem to be, and clarity in speech doesn't seem to be the goal of a lot of these inscriptions. Sometimes they're really, it's almost like different rulers from different cities are competing with each other to make the most artistic statements, almost like sometimes that you see in Islamic scripts in the Middle Ages as well. So it's it's almost something that elites are sort of using to impress each other sometimes.
Now, did other Mesoamerican cultures have written languages too?
Yes, but none were as complex as that of the Maya. So the Maya could write sentences and could basically express any human sentiment, whereas some of the other scripts that appear in Mesoamerica kind of are a little bit more like loosely pictographic, where it conveys basic ideas, but you can't really get into deep nuances of speech with them.
Is there any evidence that for instance, other Mesoamerican cultures could read the Mayan language too? Like, because the Aztec, could the Toltec or the Olmec all read Mayan language too?
I'm sure there was a lot of cross-cultural legibility. I don't really know of any examples where there's, like a Maya glyph making its way into a monument on a that of a different culture. But certainly, the words of other cultures make it into Maya text. So you can sort of sound out something that actually sounds like it might be Nahuatl, the language that's more commonly spoken in central Mexico.
We need to explain why there's only four codices extant in the world.
Yes, so that's a big story. So basically, there were probably untold hundreds of thousands made by the Maya over a period of about 1,500 years, possibly longer. When the Spanish arrived, at least in the Yucatan, there was a bishop named De Landa, the same one who recorded the alphabet, ironically. He was gathering up as many of these books as he could possibly find. And in 1562, he had a big public bonfire and burned at least 27 of them.
Oh, my God.
You can only imagine this must have happened all over the place in Mexico and Guatemala and Belize. So basically, there were three that survived, as far as anybody knew, up until the 1960s, and these three books were probably made pretty close to the time before the Spanish arrived, and they all made their ways into libraries and collections in Europe. So one is called the Dresden Codex because it's in Dresden, Germany. One's the Paris Codex, and the other one's the Madrid Codex. So basically, what happened, these books are extremely extremely delicate as well, because they're made of a bark paper and covered with thin layers of gesso. So they don't preserve very well archaeologically. So there's been a handful of fragments found here and there that are much older, but in 1971, one just sort of appeared in an exhibition in New York City. So
whoa. That must have been startling, that suddenly out of nowhere another codex appears?
I think so, yeah.
People must have been suspicious of its origins.
They absolutely were. So Michael Coe, who put the exhibition together, staked his entire reputation on the authenticity of the codex. But there's a newspaper article that came out, a review of the exhibition. A couple of prominent archaeologists are saying, like, well, I don't really want to comment on it until I've seen it closely, and we should probably be suspicious of it before we've had a chance to really look at it and examine it. So this is all fine and good. And then Coe publishes a book in 1973, 2 years after the exhibition.
Oh, that's a classic, right? That's Coe's classic book. Yeah. What's the title?
The Maya Scribe and His World.
Right.
So slightly possibly inaccurately gendered title, but really, really influential book nonetheless. So he publishes a facsimile of this codex in the book. And then all of a sudden, a couple years later, J. Eric Thompson, who was like kind of the Maya scholar of the 20th century, comes out and writes a really scathing review of it. This is actually the year that he dies, that it comes out. So, the battle doesn't really go on between Coe and Thompson, of course, obviously. But a lot of people pick up the mantle after that. And really, it's, the battle lines are drawn, and it really wasn't until a few years ago, the authenticity of this book was really resolved.
What's the story about how and where this was found?
there's a couple of different stories, but both of them are fantastic. One sounds more plausible, but the other one is actually probably the more fantastic story is probably the more accurate story.
Whoa, so you're going to have to explain why that's true, because that sounds counterintuitive.
Yeah, it is. So, sometime in the 1960s, There was a big collector of pre-Hispanic antiquities in Mexico City named Josue Sáenz, and he's well known for being the head of the Olympics Planning Committee and for the 1968 Mexico City Olympics. But beyond that, he's a huge collector of pre-Hispanic art. And so the story he gave was that the original story that he gave is that he was approached by some people about buying some amazing books that he, or some amazing objects that he had to see in person. So these would be perishable objects, wouldn't survive under normal circumstances. So he's flown into the jungle via Cessna and blindfolded part of the way.
So oh my God!
Where he's going, but he apparently knows the terrain well enough to know that he's somewhere deep in either the northern state of Chiapas or the southern part of the state of Tabasco. So he gets there, and people start showing him these objects, including what looks to be a pre-Hispanic book. There's things like a wooden box. There's a couple of wooden masks. There's all sorts of things, like a knife with a wooden handle. There's a sandal. There's a piece of rope. I mean, there's just all kinds of things that normally just wouldn't survive very well archaeologically. So he's asked if he wants to buy these things. He says he can't buy them until he has had his authenticator look at them. So he leaves a deposit. He takes the objects back to Mexico City. He has his authenticator, who was a prominent scholar at the time, look at them, and he just doesn't like the looks of them at all. So basically, Sáenz believes that he's sitting on all these fake objects. Meanwhile, the people who've shown these, have lent him these objects, basically taken the money and run. So he's kind of stuck with them.
Wow.
So So it seems
this
like
sounds like a movie plot.
Oh, it'd be a great movie. Absolutely. Yeah. So then it seems like when Michael Coe finds the book for the exhibition, it's actually in New York in a dealer's gallery, and they're basically getting ready to sell it on the market privately. So, anyway, after the exhibition, Sáenz gets in a lot of trouble with the Mexican government for basically sending out an object that may or may not be an authentic object. And if it is an authentic object, it's extremely high value. So he basically says that, oh, well, I have a friend who's a big antiquarian book collector. For my birthday, he gave me this 19th century book. As I was leafing through the pages, I found this other manuscript inside of it. Neither of us knew it was there. And so I just decided to keep it. And you know, that's how I ended up with this. So the jungle story is actually a bit more plausible, believe it or not.
Okay, go on. I detect red flags everywhere in this, but go ahead.
So supposedly, the story is that all these objects were found in a cave. So that's why they're so well preserved,
oh,
and they
God.
Were all found together. So, actually, in terms of how it's preserved and how it's the style of it, it seems like it actually could come from that part of southern Tabasco,
yep.
northern Chiapas area. So that's actually the more plausible of the story than it having been hidden inside of a more recent book.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Andrew D. Turner. He's a senior research specialist at the Getty Research Institute. Trained as an archaeologist and art historian, his work focuses on ancient Mesoamerican material culture, symbolism, and cross-cultural interaction. And we're talking about the book that he edited and contributed to, Codex Maya de Mexico, Understanding the Oldest Surviving Book of the Americas, which is just amazing to think about. Now, I assume all the scientific tests have been done on the materials of the book to prove that it was from that time period.
Yes. So basically what happened after it was called out as a fake in the 1970s, it was kind of stuck away when it returned to Mexico, it was sort of stuck away in a vault. Not many people actually had to physically examine it. So, Coe had some radiocarbon dating done on one of the pages, and it came back to be about 800 years old or something like that. So somewhere in that, I don't remember the exact number. He also had a colleague of his, Floyd Lounsbury, who was kind of the top archaeoastronomer of his era, look at the codex, and he basically decided, they decided together that it looked like this basically was a book that could be used to predict how Venus moved over a period of 104 years. So for Coe and Lounsbury, it was that was enough. And stylistically, Coe thought it was legitimate. And people either fell into that camp, or the other argument was that, well, it just doesn't look like the other three codices, so it just doesn't look real. Or they used some of the glyphs in the book in sort of strange ways that we're not familiar with. It looks fake. So basically, there wasn't really a lot in terms of scientific analysis until 2017, 2018, when the Instituto Nacional de Antropología y Historia, the National Archaeology and History Institution of Mexico, decided to mount a big study to determine once and for all authentic. So the director of the National Library of Anthropology, Baltasar Brito, he decided to put together several teams of independently working scholars who could basically address different questions of whether or not authentic. And they were specialists in different fields, like analysis of plant fibers and insect remains, destructive and non-destructive scientific analyses that could determine the presence of materials or anything with what Maya scribes would have used to make a book. And they all worked independently, and they basically all came back and unanimously said that there's absolutely nothing fishy about this book, and it's very consistent with what we would know about it. And they basically officially declared it real. Prior to that, it was called the Grolier Codex after the Grolier Club in New York, where it was displayed. But they changed the name of the book to Códice Maya de México, which were the Maya, the people who made it, and Mexico, its current place where it's held. So it's really like of the four codices, it's the only one that's actually still in the country that it came from. So now it's basically a national treasure, and it went from being a highly suspicious object to a national treasure, and then probably actually the most physically studied Mesoamerican codex of all within the course of a couple of years.
Wow. It's 10. Let's talk about the physical book. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's got a folding accordion form. I think it's called the Leporello. And that makes it portable. There are 10 pages, and it's assumed that there are 10 other pages that were there but are now missing.
That's correct.
How is that determined?
Basically, for it to be a functional Venus table, so one of the more recent codices, the Codex Dresden, has, among many other things, a Venus table that whoever was using it could have used to predict when Venus would appear in one of its four different phases over a course of 104 years. And basically the pattern that works out, and for the number to work out properly, it basically, we're looking at a chunk of the book. We're basically looking at pages, probably most likely pages like 8 through 18. There would have been like probably two more on one end and eight more on the other end. So basically that's how the numbers would work out if it was consistent with how it was done probably a couple of hundred years later, which it seems like there's no real reason to doubt that. Otherwise it's just sort of a floating, you basically have numbers that you read across from page to page, and then it just sort of stops. And then if you go back to the first page, it doesn't really add up from there. But if you were to have those extra pages, then yes, it would basically be a perfectly legible Venus table.
I want to make sure that I mention that in this book is a complete facsimile, completely annotated, of the entire book, or what we have of it. Let's talk about the paper that the Mayan used. It's called the Mate paper. How is it made? It looks at the photo reproductions of it make it look like it's very thick and very textured.
There are older examples of a mate that survived than this, but this is basically, it was determined by Susana Shalhuansi, who was the plant and plant fiber specialist who worked on it from Mexico. They basically determined that it's made out of three plies of a bark of a fig tree, so the inner bark of a fig tree. Basically, they took these long strips, and they laid them out in alternating grain patterns so that it would have some real tensile strength.
Yeah.
Normally, the way a mate is made, you can actually make it out of about 30 different types of plant, including agave, fig tree, mulberry, cotton even. And how it's made today, and actually there's really just one town where a mate is still made, is makers strip out the inner bark of a certain type of tree. They soak it and boil it to get rid of some toxins, and then they take the pulp and they pound it all together. So it's basically sort of like basically just the same way that more or less that European and paper is made, or even papyrus. But there's no evidence of crushing and pounding in the Costa Maya de Mexico. So this was actually sort of these long strips of fig tree inner bark.
And then they apply gesso to the surface so that they can draw and paint on it.
That's right. Yes. So to me, like finally seeing this object in person after years of studying it, to me, what was most striking is just how thin and uniform that layer of gesso is, too.
Wow.
So we're basically talking about plaster of Paris. So they, you know, they would take the long strips of paper and basically sort of apply these really uniform rectangular panels, with leaving just a little bit of a hinge in between so the book can fold up. And it's just so. I mean, that was really what got me, was just how wafer thin and really sort of nice and uniform. I didn't see any marks or burnishing or any
Wow.
sort of clumsiness. It was just a really skilled person that put the book together, a skilled team of people.
What are they using for pigments?
Mostly mineral pigments. Most of the red that you see is hematite, basically iron oxide.
Mm-hmm.
The black is carbon, which they would have probably just burned some wood and then collected the smoke in some sort of a vessel and then scraped out all the black. However, there is actually two types of red, and one type of red is cochineal, which is
insects.
A product of
exactly. Scale insects. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, it grows on certain types of cactus, so probably not local to where the book was made. So it was sort of a exotic luxury material that the scribes somehow got their hands on. And then there's one patch of Maya, what we call Maya blue pigment, and the Maya blue was really, really crucial for people who believed that the codex was real prior to its scientific authentication, because Maya blue is this amazing pigment that basically can't be couldn't be synthesized by modern people until the 1980s. So basically, what it is, it's a certain type of clay that comes from two sources in the Yucatan. Ancient Maya and other Mesoamerican peoples cooked this clay to a certain temperature with indigo flowers, which the blue from indigo is normally very fugitive. And basically the blue color molecules from that indigo find their way into the hollow crystalline tube-like structures of the clay, and it sort of like fuses together. So you have what would normally be a very fugitive color, extremely permanent, and basically Maya blue is now resistant to bleach, acid, almost any type of test you can put it through. So it's this really amazing color that Maya and other Mesoamerican peoples use. It just shows up in one little patch in Costa Maya de Mexico, but that was sort of enough to say that, okay, a forge couldn't really have made this in the 1960s.
Now, what's being, as you've mentioned several times, it's the phases of the observation of Venus. And this brings up the point that Mayans were incredible astronomers. And they were keeping data over hundreds of years to be able to make these kinds of calendars.
Absolutely, yeah. It's hard to imagine how long of a sort of a observation and trial and error period there must have been. But so for Venus, there's basically four phases that both we and the Maya would recognize. There's morning star phase, there's a phase of invisibility, and there's evening star phase, and there's another phase of invisibility. And basically most ancient cultures, Venus is really important for a number of reasons.
Yeah, it's visible. It's, you can see it.
It's visible. Yeah, exactly. You can see it right now as evening star very prominently. The brightest thing that shows up in the sky other than the moon in the evening sky. So, but it has this really difficult to predict pattern because it seems to, because its orbit is within the orbit of Earth.
Yep.
We're both moving around the sun at different speeds. It shows up in the sky at with regularity, but kind of not in ways that we would expect. It doesn't just move gradually across the sky like the stars do. But most ancient cultures thought that, say, morning star and evening star were two different but closely related phenomena. So classic Greeks, for example, they thought that it was two different phenomena. For the Maya and cultures of ancient Mesopotamia, they recognized that it was in fact the same planetary body that was just kind of has a very complex pattern of movement.
The calendar and the mathematics of the Mayans is amazingly complex. I mean, you're talking about periods of 104 years, which is 37,960 days. It's the length of 65 Venus cycles. And the Mayans knew this. And they observed other planets, too. We're almost out of time, but it's important to mention that they were great astronomers.
Absolutely. And to me, they made these really accurate observations, but the sort of the raw data in itself doesn't really seem to be what they were looking for. It seems like they were really interested in how all these cycles that they witnessed could sort of fit together into these larger and larger nested cycles. The sort of, you know, they definitely seem to believe that everything, that there was this order to the cosmos, and they're basically sort of trying to figure it all out from top to bottom, from human life to the cycle planting corn, all the way up to like basically just sort of like how these big cosmic planetary cycles start and finish and perpetuate.
We're almost out of time, but I want to mention there's an essay in this book by a person who is a native Mayan.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And a lot of people think these ancient cultures are gone, the people are gone, but they're still here.
Absolutely. And what's really cool and why I wanted to work with Guillermo Cantún on this is he's really a scholar in a group that's really at the forefront of sort of trying to bring back hieroglyphic literacy among Maya communities. So it's a really cool project that he works on.
This is a wonderful book. There's a for a small book, there's a lot in this. And the imagery is wild. That's all I'll say right here, but it's completely described and interpreted in the book, but you have to see the imagery. The imagery is just amazing. My guest tonight is Andrew D. Turner, Senior Research Specialist at the Getty Research Institute. Trained as an archaeologist and an art historian, his work focuses on ancient Mesoamerican material culture, symbolism, and cross-cultural interaction. And we've been talking about the book he edited and contributed to. It's really wonderful and well put together. The Codex Maya de Mexico, Understanding the Oldest Surviving Book of the Americas. Andrew, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
You'll listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.